Today is the last day of our September-October 7-day session at Chapin Mill. It's the 6th of October 2018. And we're going to take up another story from The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women, edited by Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. And this one is called Satsujo Overthrows Hakuin. And it's from 18th century Japan. It goes like this. Master Hakuin explained a koan to his student, the young laywoman Satsujo. Then he asked her, "How do you understand this?" She replied, "Would you please go over it again?" As soon as he opened his mouth to speak, she put her hands to the floor and bowed. "Thank you for your trouble," she said, and walked out, leaving Hakuin with his mouth open. Hakuin exclaimed, "Oh dear, I've been trounced by this terrible woman." Just a little bit of biographical material. I don't think Hakuin needs too much introduction. His full name is Hakuin Eikaku, and we just recited his chant and praises Zazen. His dates are 1685 to 1768. He shares his birthday with Johann Sebastian Bach, just to put it into a bit more of a Western timeline. He's one of the most influential figures in the history of Japanese Zen. He was a reformer of the Rinzai Shu, its teaching, and also renowned for his calligraphy and painting. He lived most of his life in Hara, a small village and a post station on the Tokaido, the great road that went from Tokyo to Kyoto. And he was unusual in that he did not turn away women who wanted to practice Zen. He had scores of women students, some of them from the brothels of Hara. Satsujo, we don't have any dates for her. As is often the case, but obviously she was living in Hakuin's time, younger than him. In fact, her father, Shoji Rokubei, died in 1750, was Hakuin's cousin and his boyhood playmate. This Shoji Rokubei was an influential citizen in Hara, a patron of the local Nichiren temple, Shogenji. And he studied, along with his brother, Satsujo's uncle, with Hakuin. Satsu, through her father, was exposed to the teachings of Zen at an early age. She was around 14 or 15. Her parents were worried that she wasn't going to find a husband. Some sources suggest that she was quite plain, and there's apparently a sculpture of her which seems to confirm this. perhaps we could restate it and say that she did not conform to the standards of feminine beauty of the time. And this wasn't a light matter at that time. For women, looks were very important. One's marriage was likely to determine one's well-being, in terms of material well-being at least, and probably all kinds of well-being. She was also clearly somebody of strong character, and her parents may have feared that this would be an obstruction to her finding a suitable husband as well. So they suggested that she pray to Kanon for a good husband. And by pray, this probably meant actually chanting, possibly the 10-verse Kanon Sutra that we chant. And when she received this instruction, she took it up and then discovered that she had a great affinity for it. And so she would go in secret to a local temple where there was a Kanon figure, the Akeno Kanon. So it had 11 faces. It was close to Hara in Yanagizawa. And as this temple still exists, it has huge trees in the grounds, which are now considered to be national treasures. And so she would go there and chant, and she'd also constantly chant at home, whatever she was doing, or the chores that she might have been doing, sewing, washing, cleaning, sweeping, cooking. Kanze on namu butsu yo butsu u in yo butsu u in bupo so in jo rakugajo chonin kanze on bonin kanze on ninin jushin ki ninin furishin kanze on namu butsu. So she went, she really just gave herself over to it. And after a certain length of time, she experienced an awakening. Her father peeked into her bedroom, sensing that something was up, and discovered that she was sitting on a copy of the Lotus Sutra. And he shouted at her, "Get off that sutra! Why are you sitting on a sutra?" And Satsujo replied, "The priest of Shōenji, and that's Hakuan, says that everything has the Buddha nature. How is this wonderful sutra different from my ass?" Apparently Hakun approved of this response. But it may be hard for us to get a sense of just how shocked her father might have been. He was a follower of the Nichiren school, supported the local Nichiren temple, and for the followers of Nichiren, the Lotus Sutra is the supreme among the sutras, the king of the sutras. and seem to be generating enormous good merit to pray to the sutra itself or to the characters of its name. And each of the characters of its name was said to contain all the characters of all the sutras and the merit of all the Buddhas. So to sit on the sutra was to show the utmost disrespect, sacrilege, really. And we can perhaps relate this to our own practice of taking care of the chant books. You know, we make this announcement not to stand on the chant book or bend its covers back, or the way that we treat our raksu, put it on our head in the morning and say the verse of the raksu three times. But here, Satyajo throws out all ideas of profane and sacred, and at the same time throws out the idea of the bodies being a body being impure, and of course especially the female body, and even more so the nether regions of the female body. These ideas are still alive, unfortunately. In a lot of places in Thailand, women aren't allowed into the inner sanctums of temples where the Buddha figure is, because they might pollute that space. They would have their period, so they're not allowed in at all. Dogs and cats can go in, but women can't. But the same Lotus Sutra teaches that women can awaken in their present form. There were in some teachings, in some Buddhist teachings, this notion that if you wanted to become a Buddha, you had to be reborn as a man. And there are even prayers that were for women to recite, praying that they would be reborn in as men so that they could awaken. But the Lotus Sutra taught otherwise. Krishna connects this to Master Hakuin's own words in the chant that we just did. This earth where we stand is the pure lotus land, and this very body, the body of Buddha. After this experience, Satyajo began practicing Zen full time at Hakuin's temple, and the story we're looking at today would have occurred at some point, probably fairly early on in that training that she undertook with Hakuin. It's said that she refused to marry, but then at a certain point Hakuin advised her to take her practice off the cushion, and specifically to marry and raise a family. And he said the following: "You comprehend Zen well, but you need to put it into practice. It is best for you to marry acting in accordance with the natural pairing of male and female. Spirit and form, enlightenment and actualization must be harmonized with the realities of everyday life. Earlier in the session, we touched on Hakuin's famous words about this: samadhi in everyday life is 100,000 times better than samadhi in quietude. Satsu eventually did marry. And by the way, her name, the name Satsujo, Jo is like a diminutive, so it would be used of a child or teenager. But as she gets older, it makes more sense to call her by her name without the diminutives. So it is Satsu. So she did marry and went on to have children and also grandchildren. And there's another story, famous story, that's told about her. One of her grandchildren died, and she was witnessed weeping profusely by her neighbor. And the neighbor knew about her background and thought that if she was enlightened, she would no longer experience such emotion. So he went up to her and sort of admonished her and said, if you cry like this, then people will say that you practiced with the great Master Hakuin, you were enlightened. So why are you mourning your grandchild so much? You earned a certificate of enlightenment from Hakuin himself. How can you carry on like this? And Satsu shot back, "Idiot! My tears are a better memorial than 100 priests chanting lugubriously. The tears commemorate every child that has died. That is exactly how I feel at this moment." There's another story about a master who cried when his disciple died, and people got all embarrassed, the same kind of thing, and said, "You know, you shouldn't be crying, you're supposed to be a Zen master." And he said, "If I don't cry now, when will I cry?" Grace Shiasen comments on this in her book Zen Women. Satsu lived her life as her teacher instructed, fully engaged on the cushion and off the cushion as well. True to her teacher, she expressed heartfelt emotion appropriately in an emotional situation. She did not try to live up to someone else's ideals about how Zen should express or not express itself. True to herself, she offered the same ferocious answer as a grandmother that she was known for as a teenager. After years of training, she still served a slap, but she also offered a teaching along with it. While practice may transform our experience, we retain our individuality. Satsu, an example of an awakened lay woman, is an inspiring example of Zen practice, alive and well in family life. And alive and well in the ups and downs of life. The losses, the difficulties. Back to our main story. Master Hakuin explained a koan to his student, the young laywoman, Satsujol. He then asked her, "How do you understand this?" She replied, "Would you please go over it again?" As soon as he opened his mouth to speak, she put her hands to the floor and bowed. "Thank you for your trouble," she said, and walked out, leaving Hakuin with his mouth open. Hakuin exclaimed, "Oh dear, I have been trounced by this terrible woman." So again, we get the sense of how feisty Satsujo was, and going against the, you know, the conventional behaviour expected of a young girl relating to a great Zen master. Invites him to speak, asks him to speak, and then cuts him off. She bows, but the implication here is not quite shut up, but it's at least you don't need to speak, you don't need to say anything. I wonder which koan they were looking at together that elicited this demonstration, really. Maybe it was one of the many ones about words and silence. There's the famous lines attributed to Bodhidharma. About Zen, a special transmission outside the sutras, not dependent on words and letters, direct pointing to the human heart in attaining Buddhahood. Seems a little bit like the tables have been turned here, and it's Satsujo who's teaching Hakuin, and Hakuin here really. He feigns annoyance. No doubt he would be delighted at her spirit and at her understanding of the teaching. Even before he'd opened his mouth, he'd said everything that needed to be said. There's a koan in the Hikigan Roku which is also about an exchange between a potential student and a master. Which we can contrast with this exchange between Satsujo and Hakuin. Has quite a different underlying kind of feeling to it. In this one with Satsujo, the impression we get is of a kind of playfulness and a freedom in her response. This one in the Hikigan Roku. Though is takes this in a different direction. It's called Chinzo Goes to Visit Shifuku. It's number 33 in the Hikigan Roku. Shinso, a high government official, went to see Shifuku. When Shifuku saw him coming, he immediately drew a circle in the air. Shinso said, "My coming here like this has already missed the point. How much more so to go and draw a circle?" Shifuku thereupon closed the door of his room and the doksan was over. Secho commented, "Shinso has only one eye." This master Shifuku came from the Igyo school of Zen, and the school was known for its use of symbols, especially circles. And of course, the circle in Zen is a widely used symbol. Can be an expression of wholeness. The circle that we wear over our hearts on the Raksu has this connotation to it. We're each of us whole and complete, just as we are. We don't need to add anything. And this seems to be what Chinso is saying in his response, this government official. "My coming here like this has already missed the point. How much more so to go on and draw a circle?" Okay, so if we're talking about completion, it's complete before we even start. But why did Chinso come to visit Shifuku in the first place? What was the purpose of his coming? Secho says Chinso has only one eye. That means one eye is closed. What's he not seeing? Shifuku starts by drawing this circle wide open. But then in his subsequent response to Chinso, he closes the door of his room. Seems like this open circle now has become a barrier, a closed door. What is he reacting to in Chinso? Of course, there's from one perspective, there's nowhere to go and nothing to do. We have it all, but it can be that these things, we can take them and use them as a kind of excuse for not really engaging with the practice, for not maintaining our beginner's mind. As they're saying, the devil can quote scripture. Yes, things are whole and complete. But as long as our understanding is not complete, as long as our realization is not complete, then there's work to do. It's not enough to go through the motions. Our practice has to be genuine, earnest. Honest about the limits that our understanding has. In this exchange between Chinso and Shifuku, it goes nowhere. Shifuku closes the door of his room, and the meeting was over. And yet it is in relationship, it's in interacting with others that our practice is really tested. It's why Doksan is such an important part of Sesshin. And it's also why the transition out of Sesshin and back to our everyday lives is so important. It's really, in a sense, a false boundary to think of Sesshin ending and our ordinary life starting again. We can see that from a relative point of view, but we've just got one life. Satsujo is a wonderful example to us of living wholeheartedly. She took up that chant with such energy that brought her to awakening. She engaged with Master Hakuin, all her spirit. She mourned her granddaughter. The same, wholeheartedly. So now to end, just saying a little bit about the Sesshin. And just finish with some words of Master Sheng Yin. Apply well to us. Today is the last day of retreat. That makes it the most marvelous, most solid, most to be savored of the 7 days. You have all worked hard and are already clear about the concepts and methods of Chan, and your body and mind have adapted. You have had problems, such as oblivion, scattered thoughts, illusory thoughts, attachments, selfishness, and ignorance. Hopefully you have also had moments of clarity and peace and gained some insight into yourself. You are already much improved over someone who has no self-awareness. You should at least have become more sincere and more genuine, more honest about where you are at and the work that is to be done. Most important, you now have the power to face yourself. Let us value this last day. If we can meditate well, every second is worth more than gold. Otherwise, time passes in the blink of an eye, and even 100 years of sitting won't be worth excrement. As for the teaching I have given, be content to have listened and used as much as you could. This is always important to remember, just to take what you need from Taisho and leave the rest. Remember the following points when doing Chan. Relax body and mind, but hold on to the method. If you use the method, just pick it up again. Do not think of success or failure. Just accept the practice as the goal. This is probably the most important piece of teaching we can take in. To see our practice as the goal. To practice for its own sake. Just by letting go, you are making progress. Use the mirror of remorse to reflect on yourself and the pure water of repentance for self-cleansing. Use the power of the mind of enlightenment to help sentient beings. To attain Buddhahood, we must first benefit sentient beings. It's notable that the first of our four vows is the one about saving sentient beings, liberating all beings. To attain Buddhahood, we must first benefit sentient beings. Use the power of diligent progress to perfect yourselves. The true hallmark of a Chan person is the perfection of compassion and wisdom. We'll stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma days beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow.